Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 197. I'm recording it on Saturday, January 2nd, 2010. The Peak 10 level today is 20. That's on the high side for those considering investing in stocks. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of the selection is Pilot Error. The title of the podcast is The Logic of Buy and Hold. I don't think there's going to be anything shockingly new in this podcast. I often talk about the logic of buy and hold. Buy and hold is the dominant investing model of today, the one that's causing all the trouble. And I do not believe in buy and hold investing. I like to think of myself as the most severe critic of buy and hold investing alive on the planet today. I advocate an alternate model, the opposite model, that I call rational investing. And the difference is that buy and hold says that there is no need to change your stock allocation in response to dramatic price changes. The rational investing model says you must change your stock allocation in response to dramatic price changes. But it's a constant source of, I don't know, perplexment's not a word. Constant source of perplexity? It perplexes me no end. Let's say it that way. It perplexes me no end that people, so many people, continue to hold on to the buy and hold model. Don't want to give up on the buy and hold model. And so, you know, most of the podcasts I recorded are an effort either to explain why you should not do that, or an effort to come to terms myself with why it is that so many have a hard time giving up the buy and hold model. And one of the things going on is the title of this podcast is The Logic of Buy and Hold. Well, buy and hold, I sometimes call it insane. And I believe it's insane. I mean, that's my honest conclusion. However, when I say it's insane, I don't mean to suggest that it's not logical. I believe buy and hold investing is almost rigidly logical. It's an intensely logical system of thought. And that seems like a paradox. It is a paradox. And there's a quote from C.K. Chesterton. He was a Catholic writer. I don't know what years he was writing, sometime back. And I've read one or two books by him. You see a lot of his quotes written in different articles. He's often quoted. I think he was a newspaper writer for some time, maybe editorials or something, and he wrote some books. Oh, he wrote the Father Brown. I believe he wrote the Father Brown mystery novels. I think he's somewhat famous for that. I'm trying to think of his books. I know he wrote a book called, I believe it was called Orthodoxy. He wrote one called something like What's Wrong with the World Today. I believe that may be the one I read a long time ago. But Chesterton had a quote. I found this. I don't know if I entered his name or I was just looking for quotes on this subject, and I found a quote by him, and then I went from there to a collection of Chesterton quotes and found some great ones and found one from my book because I was looking for a quote on this theme. But there was a quote from Chesterton, and I can't quote it exactly, but I'm going to use it as the epigraph of the book I'm writing on Investing for Humans. And Chesterton says, and this is not exact quote, but he says something to the effect of, it's not... he says the insane man, the madman, I think he says, the madman is not the man who has lost the use of logic. The madman is the man who has lost the use of everything but logic. And that nails it as far as buy and hold investing is concerned. Buy and hold, and it's part of the problem we have. Buy and hold is an intensely logical system of thought. So on the one hand, you have to get in there and grapple with the logical deficiencies, because the whole thing pretends to be a logical edifice. In other words, the whole thing sort of, the claim is we're rational, we're logical, and nobody else is. That's the whole claim of the buy and holders. They claim to be superior. This is what's so off-putting about buy and hold. The reason I use such strong language to criticize it is there are other investing schools. There are day traders, you know, the momentum investors, technical investors, value investors. They're all, you know, contrarian investors. But none of these people really have this pompous arrogance that is characteristic of those who advocate buy and hold. I don't know that any of the other schools of thought say we're the only ones, we have the market on the truth. We're the only ones that are scientific, you know, we're the only ones that use historical data, we're the only ones that have the truth. But buy and holders always do this. I've come to believe it's what buy and hold is. It's just, it's like an arrogant pose. I mean, I state things strongly, but I do that because I believe it. I think buy and hold has been a disaster. But fortunately or unfortunately, the wonderful thing about buy and hold is it really, these claims are half true. They're not true. They don't have a market on the truth by any stretch. But it is true that buy and hold was an attempt to become more systematic in our understanding of stock investing. And I think that's wonderful. I think it was a huge advance. And so, on the one hand, I'm the biggest advocate of buy and hold in the world. I'm not an advocate of how it turned out, but I'm an advocate of the project. I think the project, the buy and hold project, making stock analysis scientific, it's wonderful. It's the greatest thing in personal finance to happen in my lifetime. But the greatest mistake in personal finance was this, I call it a decision, but there was no day when people got together and made a decision. They just sort of drifted into it. But this choice or decision made by the buy and holders to, instead of remaining open to criticism and to change and to improvement in their system, they became arrogant and pompous and decided, you know, we've got all the answers and we don't need to listen to anybody else and we're better than everybody else and we're going to stop hearing the other point of view. We're just going to keep patting ourselves on the back forevermore. You know, we figured it all out. We're right. Everybody else is wrong. And this is what buy and hold has become. So it's a strange sort of thing. The question is, how do you attack buy and hold? Do you attack it from the logic, which is what they put forward? They claim that it's a logical system. So therefore, if you can show flaws in the logic, you know, that should do it. But the reality, or they claim their database system, if you can show that the data doesn't support it, you would think that would do it. But the reality is, you talk to buy and holders, and I've talked to thousands and thousands on different discussion boards and blogs, and they're not impressed. When you point out the logical failings of the buy and hold model, they're not even, it doesn't even slow them down. It doesn't, you know, doesn't, they're not impressed. Showing them the historical data shows that they've got it totally wrong. Again, not interested, not impressed. So at root, what's going on is that buy and hold is a purely emotional strategy. There's no logic to it at all. It's just a rationalization is what's going on. Is it what buy and hold is a get-rich-quick scheme. The whole idea of buy and hold is that when prices go up more than the market, more than the economic realities permit, which is what happened in the 1990s, logic, common sense would tell you, you have to pay for that. That those price increases are financed, they're borrowed from future returns. Common sense would tell you that that's so. You wouldn't have to know anything about stock investing to know that. I think a 7-year-old would get that. But the whole idea of buy and hold is to create this huge intellectual edifice that says, oh, no. We've got to rationalize everything. And we come up with pretend logical arguments and pretend data that convinces us that, oh, yes, we can ignore the entire history of stock investing. We can ignore common sense. And we can build this contraption that tells us that, yes, we can do what feels emotionally good. We can go with the get-rich-quick scheme, and there'll be no price to pay, and we've quote-unquote proven it. We've proven it. You know, it's mathematical calculation. Reality doesn't matter anymore. Reality principle's been repealed because we've got formulas, you know. I mean, Bill Bernstein had this comment not too long ago at the Bogleheads board, and he said, only 2% of the investing public is good enough at math to understand how to invest without an advisor. You know, only 2%. Because they don't understand his formulas. But see, the formulas aren't necessary. You don't need to understand formulas to understand how to invest. The formulas are only necessary if you're trying to kid yourself into believing that valuations don't matter. And that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices change dramatically. In other words, you only need these formulas if you're a buy and holder. If you're not a buy and holder, all you need to know is, are stocks well priced? Buy them. Are stocks poorly priced? Don't buy them. It's common sense, just like you buy anything else, a house or a car or comic book or a sweater or, you know, pajamas or anything else. But when you enter this strange, logical world of buy and hold, and it is a logical world, it's a sterile logical world, an excessively logical world, a world where only logic intervenes and common sense is not permitted, historical data is not permitted, discussion of different viewpoints is not permitted. There's the use of logic, but the logic is not aimed at what you would think it would be aimed at. You would think that the logic would be aimed at discovering truth. But in the mind of the buy and hold investor, the purpose of logic is to rationalize, to avoid truth, not to discover it. So, and my strong sense is that many middle-class investors don't know this. You know, there's different groups of investors, and the die-hard buy-and-holders, well, they don't know it themselves. They're sort of suffering from cognitive dissonance. They're defensive, so they sort of know it. They know that valuations is the weak link in this chain, but they're careful never to study valuations, so they don't know the realities. But the larger group of middle-class investors, and millions and millions of people, don't study investing. They don't care about these mathematical formulas. And all they know is Money Magazine and the Wall Street Journal and, Vanguard and all these other places are telling them buy and hold's a good idea. And they think these people must know. These people are very smart, and they are smart. And these people, you know, they wear suits and they look respectable, and they're all telling me buy and hold works, and they must know what they're talking about. They couldn't possibly all have gotten it wrong, could they? And the answer is yes, they've all gotten it wrong. Not 100%, but 90% of the investing experts have gotten it wrong. And the 10% who have gotten it right rarely get much of a forum. You know, you can find them on the internet. If you do searches, you can find them, but you don't hear about them much. So the danger here is just, you know, incalculable. You've got the situation where millions of people are investing according to this model, and the entire model purports to be science, which is what gives it credibility in the eyes of the millions of investors. But it's all, I'm tempted to say it's all a fraud. It's a fraud in that it's not real. It's fake. But it's not a fraud in that there's not evil intent. The people who came up with buy and hold believe it. They believe it. They try to get you to believe it. They believe it themselves, but they're stone cold unwilling to discuss the weak points in their ideas, because it really was never an intellectual exercise to begin with. That's just as I say, it's a get rich quick scheme at core. Now, I don't think that's true of the academics that came up with it. They weren't interested in the get-rich-quick scheme, but for them, it was more of an intellectual puzzle. They wanted to, but again, it became emotional. In other words, their interest is not making money. Their interest is not get-rich-quick, but their interest is being right. They came up with an economic theory, and the theory has some surface plausibility, and they got all excited. They felt that they had discovered the answer of stock investing, and they won Nobel Prizes and all this sort of thing. And they said, you know, we don't want to admit we're wrong. And for 30 years now, the data has showed, the academic research has showed they are wrong. And they just don't want to admit it. You know, that's the problem. So the problem is purely emotional. There is no intellectual debate over buy and hold, says Rob Bennett. There is no intellectual debate. There are smart people who believe in it. That I know for certain. But they don't have any arguments. Their only argument is, if you present the arguments against what they say, their argument is, we don't like you. Shut up. You know, that's their argument. So what I want to do in this podcast is to go over some of the intellectual, I think of it as a logic chain. So I'll just, the points on the logic chain that added together constitute the buy and hold model of stock investing. So as I say, many of these points I've made in earlier podcasts, and I'm just sort of collecting them in one place so that someone interested in the theory of buy and hold and what's wrong with it will have a place to go to hear. And I think I have 21 points to make, 21 sort of intellectual points in the logic chain for buy and hold, and why those points are weak. Now, so as I say, one point I wanted to make in preface is buy and hold does not lack anything in the logic department. I mean, the logic does not hold up, but there's lots of logical connections being made. So this is what fools you. This is the number one message I want to convey in this podcast is, don't be fooled. Seeing people use big words doesn't mean they're smart. People don't use big words because they're smart. People use big words because they're trying to impress you, because they're not smart. If they were smart, they wouldn't have to impress you with big words. They could just talk like a normal person. When people use big words, my spidey sense starts to tingle. When people tell me, oh, you got to look at the sharp ratio, you know, we can't explain that to you, Rob. We can't answer your question because you're too dumb. You don't know numbers. And anyway, you don't know the sharp ratio. If you knew the sharp ratio, it would all be clear to you. And I'm like, what? Just tell me what the deal is. You know, don't give me the sharp ratio BS. So what's going on with buy and hold is it's all a cover story. And so what I want to do in this podcast is go through 21 of the sort of intellectual points they make and point out the failings so that you don't fall for this stuff. Because it all is rationalizations. There is some good stuff. Some of it, one of the alternate titles I considered was The Logic and Half-Truths of Buy and Hold. And I just decided to make it shorter, just the logical buy and hold. But a lot of these things are half-truths. And the true part, this is what's so sad, what's so tragic about it is, the true part is often wonderful. In other words, some of the stuff that the buy and hold advocates have come up with is gold. Not a small amount, really. I mean, I would say the majority of it is gold. It's just, there's one idea that's wrong, and that's the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels. That is insane, and that idea is so wrong that it poisons all the rest. And so instead of having a logical system, you have a non-logical system. You have a system that has logic on the surface, but that takes you to a very non-logical place, an extremely emotional place. And the second point I wanted to make in preface is that, there's a great danger in the buy and hold model, the way it's set up. It's a closed system. What I mean by that is, I can take any of these 21 points and isolate it and explain to you the good points and the bad points to the intellectual argument being made. But buy and holders, they accept the whole thing. And when you accept the whole thing, all they do is, if you take, you know, say there, I mean, I don't know if there are, I use 21 points, but there's different ways to measure it. You could say there's 15 points or there's 30, whatever, different ways of cutting it, you know, breaking it down. Anytime you attack one of the points, they rush for safety in another point. This is what they do. I've seen this thousands of times. So no one point needs to work as far as they're concerned. As long as they've got another point, and different elements of the theory contradict each other. So they can always defend their points by running for safety to another point. But if you add it, the whole thing together, it self-contradicts. The whole thing just crumbles to the ground. But they don't care to notice that. They're not interested. So if you point out the weaknesses of any of the 21 points, they'll just say, oh, yeah, well, that's answered by this other point. And they'll go around and around in circles. Then when you point out why the other point doesn't work, they'll say, oh, well, that's answered by yet another point. And then you'll point out how that one's wrong, and they'll say, well, that answered by another one. And eventually you've covered all 21, and all 21 are false in some significant way. But by that point, they've exhausted you by having to make you go through 21 explanations. And you get to the 21st one, and you say, now this is the 21st one that is wrong. And then they go back to the first. They say, oh, yeah, but that's explained by this one. And then you start all over again. It's a closed system. They don't allow testing. They do not allow testing of the logic of this system. And if you don't allow testing of the logic, you know, what you've got is not logic. You know, the whole idea, the whole thing that makes something scientific is it's subject to testing. If you have to take it on faith, it's not science. It's not logic. And buy and hold has to be taken on faith. I have never seen anyone make a case for buy and hold that was not rooted in a faith-based argument. It's always, I can explain why buy and hold works if, the biggest word in the English language, I can explain why buy and hold works if you start by believing in buy and hold. If you have 100% confidence that buy and hold works and that nothing else can ever work, I can then explain why it works. But if you have any doubts about any of it, and you're not willing to take it on faith, I can't explain it. There is no explanation. I have these words. I have these word games I can go take you through, and I can say, you know, these trite marketing slogans. You know, timing doesn't work. I mean, you know, buy and hold, stay the course, you know, stocks for the long run. I can cite these slogans, but that's it. I can't explain why timing doesn't work. I can't give you any evidence it doesn't work. I can't explain why stocks for the long run. I can't give you any evidence. I can just cite these marketing slogans over and over and over and over again. But they sound scientific, don't they? Because when they present the marketing slogans, they present charts and tables and data and studies and all this sort of thing. They dress it up to look like science, but when you push a little bit, the science collapses. So that's the overview. Now I'm going to try to go through the 21 points. The first one, the logic of buy and hold. The market knows best. I think this is the one that catches the most people. As I mention this all the time, people who believe in buy and hold are smart. They're not dummies. And it's sad because that's what impresses the average investor. I mean, the average investor is not a dummy. The average middle-class investor is not a dummy. If they were dummies, they wouldn't have money to invest. But the average middle-class investor is a dummy when it comes to stocks because they just don't care. They don't care. You know, they have a job and they've got a family to raise and they like to take in a movie every now and again, and they don't want to spend their time studying stock investing. So they defer to what they think of as experts. They say, well, I'll let the experts tell me the story. You know, it's sort of like a lot of people defer to their doctors. You know, I don't want to know what a so-and-so operation does. Just, you know, do whatever you have to do to me and fix me so that I can go out and, you know, live my life. But I don't really want to know how you do what you do. I don't want to know the yucky details. They do that with investing, but doctors, I have a little confidence in. I hope doctors are doing a better job than investing experts, or I'm in big trouble as I get up in years. But my experience with doctors is, you know, they do a reasonably good job. But investing experts, no, I don't have much confidence. I used to, but not anymore. I don't have much. Not after I've looked into this. I don't have much confidence anymore. And not that they're not smart people. They're smart people. But and I think they're good people. But no, they don't know nearly what they think they know. Our knowledge of investing is primitive today. And they feel that they have to act as though they know it all. But the thing that captures a lot of people is this idea. It's one of the intellectual links in the buy and hold concept, that the market knows best. And I'll present You know, I've gone to blogs where I respect the guy writing the blog or the woman, and I'll say, you know, here's an argument, you know, from here's a data-based argument showing that you know, stocks are not a good value proposition today. And they'll come back and they'll just say, well, okay, you know, Rob, very interesting, you know, good work there. But got to tell you, the market seems to think stocks are okay. And it's really, it has a magical power. I mean, people just feel if the market says it, that's it. Now, this is the most, it's probably the most frustrating argument, because I am sort of a pro-market guy, so they're making an argument that I'd be inclined to make myself. What they're really saying is, what I'm usually saying is, stocks are overvalued, and therefore they offer a poor value proposition. I always give the example, in January 2000, Treasury inflation-protected securities were paying a long-term return of 4% real per year, and stocks were paying a most likely long-term return of a negative 1% per year. It's a differential of 5 percentage points of return per year, for 10 years running. You do the math, and at the end of 10 years, you've lost 50% of your initial investment just by being a buy and holder. You've lost 50% of your life savings from that one decision to follow a buy and hold strategy rather than to switch to tips, because stocks were so insanely overvalued. And you'll say, why did you do that? Why do you think that's a good decision? And the buy and holders will say, oh, the market said that price was okay. In other words, if the market thought that tips were better than stocks, the market price for stocks would have dropped. The logic is impeccable. The quote-unquote logic. It should be that way. They're right. And this is what's so frustrating to me, is that what they're saying should be right. The market should have, the price of stocks should have dropped. But it didn't. They won't accept that. In other words, they will quote you over and over again. They'll just keep saying, the market says it. Like it's like there's some magical incantation. You say the word market and the discussion's over. And I just say, okay, you're right. Stocks were valued 3 times fair value in January 2000. The market should have priced them properly. Therefore, the price should have fell by 2/3. But it didn't. Does that not matter? Just to say it should happen, it didn't happen. Now, the way I would go with that is I'd say, okay, that's a puzzle. Why did it not drop? And the answer, in my opinion, is the thing I call the ban on honest posting. You can't, you know, we have bans on honest posting at Motley Fool, at Morningstar, at Bogleheads, at Index Universe, Early Retirement Forum. In other words, you can't tell people what the historical data says about stock investing today, or you'll be banned. Well, doesn't that tell you that why the market's not functioning? The market's not functioning because the market is us, and we don't have the information we need to make informed decisions. So, of course, the market's not functioning. So that's the answer to the claim that the market said this, so the market must be right. The market set this price, and thus the price must be right. No, the market is us. And if we don't allow ourselves to become informed about what the price should be, obviously, the market can't function. We are the market. But do you see how there is a logic there? Saying, I'm going to let the market set the price rather than me. It's almost an act of humility. These people are saying, I don't think I can do a better job than the market. I'm going to just go with what the market says. That's almost an act of humility. It's commendable in a way. But once you learn that the market doesn't do it, and of course, if stocks are overvalued, obviously the market is not setting the price properly. The phrase overvalued is the opposite of the phrase properly priced. It can't be both. So the fact that stocks were overvalued tells you that the market failed, but the buy and holders every time you point out that stocks are overvalued, they'll just repeat over and over again, well, the market says that's the right price. I mean, it's like a magical incantation. It's a sound argument to say we should. It's certainly a sound to say we should look at what the market did. Intuitively, you would think the market would set the price properly. But when we see evidence that it's not so, we should follow up on that and figure out what the heck's going on here. Maybe we need to open the internet up to honest postings to get this market functioning again. But the buy and holders don't do that. They just, that's why I say it's logic up to a point. But then the logic turns off. And the logic just says, the market says it, and I'll just keep repeating that over and over and over and over again. Point two, it's better to bet on the entire economy than on just one company. The whole idea, this is the indexing concept. Rather than picking an individual stock, you will pick the entire, you will pick a broad index fund. I think that's a brilliant idea. So that's part of the logic of buy and hold that I very much buy into. Because it's great diversification. When you buy the whole market, you really are locking in the market return. Whereas when you pick an individual company, the company might do well, the company might do bad. I think you can get higher returns doing that. I think there's higher potential, but there's risk because you might pick wrongly. When you buy the whole market, I think of it as good enough investing. You're not going for the highest possible return, but you're locking in a market result, and the market result is usually a good thing with stocks. The average return on stocks in the U.S. is 6.5 real. That's a very good return. So there's great logic in that second point, in my opinion. Third, stocks are best for the long run. This is a key claim. Big reason, I think, for the insane bull market was this idea that stocks are always best for the long run. Of course, it was a popular book title by Jeremy Siegel in the 90s. Jeremy Siegel's onto something, but he's got it wrong. The title is wrong. What it should be is not that stocks are best for the long run, and that's the claim that's made. The book title is Stocks for the Long Run, but the claim being made is that stocks are best for the long run. The proper claim is stocks are predictable in the long run. It's a very, very different claim. It sounds similar on the surface, doesn't sound that different, but the strategic implications are huge. The reality is stocks are unpredictable in the short term, predictable in the long term. But they are at some prices, they are predictably good. At some prices, they're predictably insanely good. And in some prices, they're predictably insanely bad. So the price levels that applied from January 96 through September 2008, the long-term performance of stocks was highly predictable, as it always is, but it was predictably bad. In other words, if you put your money in stocks at those prices, you were almost sure to suffer financially, or hurt yourself, hurt your chances of achieving a middle-class retirement in a reasonable amount of time. That's not the way Jeremy Siegel says it. He doesn't say stocks, are sometimes predictably good and sometimes predictably bad. His suggestion or his claim is that stocks are predictably good in the long run, and that doesn't hold up to scrutiny. So, the logic there, again, is a half-truth. The truth is very important. The idea that stocks are predictable is of huge importance. That's the holy grail of stock investing, the fountain of youth of stock investing. People have always wanted to invest in stocks because of the great returns. They've always been scared of the unpredictability of stocks. We now have the ability to predict long-term stock returns. What a godsend. But the only thing blocking us from taking advantage of this information today is that the buy and holders want to think that stocks are always predictably good, and therefore they become angry. If you tell them that what the long-term return is, they get upset. They'll ban you from their discussion boards because they say, we don't want to hear what stocks are going to do in the long term. Why? Because, from 96 forward, the last 15 years, stocks have been predictably bad, not in the long term, not predictably good, and they don't want to hear that. It's a dogma of buy and hold that stocks are always good, and they don't want to hear that. Even if it means it's going to delay their retirement by 5 years, they don't want to question the dogma. There's an emotional attachment to these dogmas. So again, on the surface, you've got logic, but what's driving buy and hold is an emotional desire for a get-rich-quick approach. Point four, stay the course. Stay the course is another one of these marketing slogans. It has great appeal. You know, you sometimes wonder if they market tested these slogans, you know, if they sent people around and found out what slogans middle-class investors most wanted to hear and then cooked up the ones they came up with, because they're so perfect. They all hit these emotional hot buttons, just like all good advertising does, all good marketing campaigns do. And stay the course is wonderful for marketing purposes, because what the middle-class investor wants is something stable, something real. He doesn't want all this. He doesn't want get-rich-quick schemes. He doesn't want that. I'm confident that there's marketing data showing that. That if you interviewed middle-class investors, because I've talked to thousands and thousands of them, and you just hear this over and over again. But stay the course suggests that that's what buy and hold. It's a favorite slogan of John Bogle, who is a big promoter of buy and hold, and it suggests stability. It suggests prudence. It suggests long-term focus. It suggests all kinds of good things. But then when you check how Bogle, what's he mean by stay the course? Does he mean stay at the same risk level? If he did, it would be wonderful. But of course, to stay at the same risk level, you would need to change your stock allocation as the risk of stocks changes. As stocks become more risky at high prices, you'd have to lower your stock allocation so that your risk would remain roughly the same. But is that what Bogle recommends? No. He recommends staying at the same stock allocation. In other words, let your risk level go wildly up and down. How's that stay the course? So, again, you've got surface logic, but push a little bit, and what you find is emotional insanity. Point five, buy and hold. Very similar story to stay the course. I think of those two things as essentially synonyms. For a long time, I used to, when I was criticizing buy and hold, I would instead use the phrase passive investing. I would criticize passive investing. And passive investing is states it more clearly. You know, the thing you're passive about is your stock allocation. So the phrase passive investing says it more clearly. And I used to be reluctant to criticize buy and hold because I think of myself as sort of being in favor of buy and hold. Buy and hold, again, suggests stability. It suggests prudence. It suggests long-term thinking. But if buy and hold, again, if it meant sticking with the same risk level, I'd be all in favor of it. And I have a section of my book I call The New Buy and Hold. And that's, with valuation-informed indexing, is the new buy and hold. You don't stick with the same allocation, but you try to you make an effort to stick with the same risk level. But I got to a point where I realized the average middle-class person thinks of buy and hold as sticking with the same stock allocation. So I can put this positive interpretation on it, but that's not the interpretation that investors are putting on it, and that's not the interpretation that the stock selling industry is pushing. And so the reality is buy and hold has become a get-rich-quick scheme. It, you know, it doesn't sound like a get-rich-quick scheme, does it? It sounds like stability, but the stability being sought with buy and hold is not stability of risk. That would be a workable strategy. The stability being sought is stability of allocation, which means risk is bouncing all over the place. So there is no stability. And again, you've got surface logic, but you know, you push a little bit, and what you find out is an intense emotionalism and rationalization layered on top, so that you don't see the emotionalism, so that it's covered up. Point six, allocation is the most important factor. This is something on which I think the logic of buy and hold stands up, and buy and holders, I think, would agree that the stock allocation that the investor chooses is the most important decision the investor makes. Not everyone says the same allocation. Different buy and holders. Some will say you should go with a high allocation. Some are more prudent, and they'll say a moderate allocation. Obviously, some say you should change your allocation at different ages or different risk tolerances. So there's no one allocation that anyone says is best. But I think the vast majority of buy and holders would say that the most important thing the investor has to do is to set his allocation properly. And I strongly agree. Some say allocation is, you know, like 90% of investing success. That sounds high to me, but I certainly would say it's the most important factor. And of course, my objection to buy and hold is, with buy and hold, you're guaranteed to get the allocation wrong. Why? Because the best allocation varies depending on the risk level or depending on the valuation level. So, you know, if you determine the best allocation for you at a time of moderate price is 60% stocks, then obviously you don't want to be 60% at a time of insanely high price. Maybe you want to be 30%. Or you don't want to be 60% at a time of insanely low price. Maybe you want to be 90%. So if you choose buy and hold, if you choose the same allocation at all times, your allocation is guaranteed to be wrong most of the time. Obviously not a good idea. But that's a logical follow-up to the idea that, you know, buy and holders say allocation is the most important thing, but they also say you shouldn't change your allocation. What sense does that make? On the surface, there appears to be this logic. They stress allocation, which is important, but when you get to implementation, the logic breaks down. Point seven, all else is financial porn. Buy and holders are notorious. You know, they're extremely sensitive. In other words, question any of the buy and hold dogmas, and they go bonkers. But how often do buy and holders they're vicious in their attacks on other investing strategies? You know, this is financial porn. Everything's financial porn. I mean, at the Vanguard Diehards board and now the Bogleheads .org board, it becomes a comedy at times. I mean, the most gentle, you know. They would be at Morningstar. Morningstar was hosting their board, the Vanguard Diehards, and Morningstar would put up an article, you know, praising some other strategy, and they would just go bonkers. You know, it's financial porn. I mean, they used to argue that Money Magazine should never write about anything but buy and hold. Anything else is financial porn. Incredibly, you know, money links to them. Money linked to the Bogleheads.org board is one of the best. I mean, I agree in a way. It's one of the best. I actually like the board a lot, but it's a strange thing to have them. They're vicious in their criticisms of money. They're very happy to get linked. They have no problem with the link, but they're vicious. You know, they'll say, "Oh, money is just financial porn." You know, but we'll take the link. You know. Anyway, strange paradox there in my head, but my view is, there is such a thing as financial porn. That's real. So in that sense, I go along with the buy and holders. You know, they're pointing people to something they need to know about. They're trying to help people. But this negativity is too intense. And my view is, instead of calling everybody financial porn, why not just start with the presumption that maybe people are doing the best they can? And yes, people do try to sell. But that's true of the buy and holders. They're trying to sell something. You know, they're like, as if they're immune, as if they're not trying to sell something. You know, we're all flawed creatures. Most of us are trying to sell something. And you need to take away points for that. But all of this nasty, you know, calling something financial porn isn't terribly helpful. I do call buy and hold financial porn. So I maybe to some extent I'm guilty of that. But I try to give both sides of the story. I call it financial porn because what I try to do is to call the ideas financial porn while pointing out that the people who came up with the ideas were well-intentioned and were trying to help people learn how to invest. So I try to distinguish between the ideas, which I view as truly dangerous, and the people who came up with them, who for the most part I think are well-intentioned and you know, have taught us many important things. And I think that's true of all these others. You know, all the people they criticize, these people can teach important things, and we should learn from them. I mean, there are buy and holders that would call Warren Buffett financial porn. I swear. I mean, that's sort of, anyway, I better stop. But they're off the charts on this stuff. It's defensiveness. It's defensiveness. This need to attack others is defensiveness. Point eight. Focus on academic research. This part, I think they're right. I think the idea of using academic research to learn how to invest is wonderful. I think it's the most exciting development in personal finance in my lifetime. The whole idea that Eugene Fama and Burton Malkiel and John Bogle would start turning to the academic research to learn how to invest rather than just subjective opinions where everybody, you know, everybody says, I think stocks are going up. No, I think they're going down. It's a big waste of time. So I applaud that. However, again, the buy and holders, they claim to love academic research, but there's been academic research for 30 years now showing that valuations affect long-term return, and they don't like that academic research. So you're not allowed to talk about that academic research. That academic research is taboo among buy and holders. And if you love academic research, you love it, whether it supports your prejudices or not. The whole point of academic research is to get objective feedback. And if you're going to tune out any academic research that doesn't support your particular biases, you might as well forget about academic research. Academic research isn't going to help you. You know, just be upfront and just say, these are my biases, and that's how I'm going to invest, and I don't care what the academic research says. If you tune it out, all you're doing is making your strategy more dangerous by giving it this veneer of science when all it is emotionalism. You know, better to just say, you know, it's sort of like being at the racetrack, you know, and you'll take your kids and they'll say, you know, I'm going to bet on horse number three. And you say, why? And they say, because he's got a green, you know, he's green. You know, he's got a green jacket. You know, the jockey has a green jacket. It might sound like a stupid reason, but it's better to vote for a horse because he's got a green jacket than to go through all these convoluted to look at, you know, look at the program and find out what he's done in earlier races and find out that the three horse is the worst one and just say, I'm going to vote for him anyway. In other words, why look at the data if you're going to ignore it? You're better to just be, at least if you're innocently saying I vote for him because he's green, well then if somebody can point you to a reason the other way, you'll switch. In other words, if somebody else can say, well, wait a minute, this green horse has lost 10 races in a row, and you say, well, yeah, you know what, I like red, you know, at least you won't be dogmatic about it. But when you go through these convoluted arguments for why you've got to go with the three horse, then, you know, if somebody presents you evidence that you're wrong, you get into this defensive mode and you say, I'm going to ban you. Shut up. You know, I'm voting for three and I'm going to double my bet just to prove you wrong. You know, you get into all this crazy stuff. And so, you know, academic research is wonderful, but you have to use it in a realistic, reasonable way. And when it becomes so emotionally charged, it hurts you more than it helps you, in my opinion. Point nine, historical data. Same basic thing. Academic research and historical data. Obviously, the academic research is based on historical data, but same thing. The buy and holders are right to use historical data to guide their decisions, but it just kills me. You know, I had this statement. I used to post it at Vanguard Diehards all the time, and I'd say, there have been four times in U.S. history when we've been to the price levels we're at today. This was back before the crash, and I'd say there have been four times in U.S. history. The first three times, the average price loss was 68% real. What do you think's going to happen this time? And it's data that, you know, they can't. They'd say, well, we're going to ban you, Rob. Well, you can ban me, but you can't ban the data. The data still says what it says. And, of course, we had a loss of 55%, and I think it's fair to say that another stock crash is likely in years to come. So we're going to get to that 68% mark. But, you know, that was, they didn't like that data. They didn't like that data. So the idea that what they would say is, oh, we love the data because the data says stocks provide an average return of 6.5. And that's true. It's true. So the fact that they look at the data is a good thing, but why not look at the data that shows that at certain valuation levels the likely return is in 6.5? At the valuation levels at the top of the bull market, the most likely long-term return was a negative number. How about looking at that data? Of course, you don't just selectively you know, cherry pick bits of data that make you happy to overinvest in stocks. That's not a database analysis. That's using data to support an emotional bias. And it's the wrong reason to use data. Point 10, no such thing as a free lunch. Well, I have an entire podcast on, you know, arguing that there is such a thing as a free lunch. And this is the one that's most maddening of all, because this phrase, there's no such thing as a free lunch, it's the ultimate trump card for the illogical buy and holder. What you do is, you can discuss anything. There's been data showing for years now that value stocks do better than the market as a whole. So what do the buy and holders say in the face of, you know, a wealth of data showing they're wrong? Oh, well, there's no such thing as a free lunch. If value investing was better, then that would be a free lunch. And there's no such thing as a free lunch. And so it's not true. Doesn't matter what the data says, it's not true. I mean, you could say that about anything. You know, somebody said, well, there was an example. Artie, it posted at my blog. He talked about this guy. I forget all the details. Some story about a guy who was digging a hole out in the desert or something, and his hands were all calloused and bloody and everything. And guy came by and said, you know, what? You know, here's a shovel. Why don't you use this shovel? And, you know, the guy got angry, and basically the guy was saying, there's no such thing as a free lunch. If a shovel would have helped, I would have had a shovel from the beginning. I didn't have a shovel. I've been making my hands bleed. No shovels work. No such thing as a free lunch. In other words, if we adopt this attitude, there's no such thing as a free lunch, why not just say, there's no such thing as intelligence. There's no such thing as learning. There's no such thing as caring. There's no such thing as progress. There's no such thing as hope. There's no such thing as love. There's no such thing as life. Buy and holders live in a dead, sterile world. They know everything. And if ever they learned something, they'd have to condemn what they learned, because if they admitted that they learned something, that would be a quote-unquote free lunch. Anything positive is a free lunch. And so once buy and hold became dominant, our hopes as a people of learning how investing works were stopped. The clock stopped in 1981. 1981 is when Yale professor Robert Shiller published his research showing that valuations affect long-term returns and the chances of buy and hold working in the real world are precisely zero. And the clock stopped. The buy and holders could have learned from that, and they could have taken the good in buy and hold and made it 10 times better by taking all the wonderful insights that really do work and combining them with these new insights developed by Shiller and making the whole thing the best approach to investing we've ever seen, rational investing. But instead they said, oh, no such thing as a free lunch. If valuations really affected long-term returns, we could predict long-term returns and there wouldn't be any risk in stock investing. We could take away 80% of the risk. That would be a free lunch. Can't have that. We didn't know that. When Burton Malkiel wrote his book, he didn't know that. So that would be a free lunch. If it wasn't in Burton Malkiel's book published in 1974, it would be a free lunch. Can't have it. No such thing as a free lunch. That drives me crazy. Life is a free lunch. Did you pay for a ticket to this adventure? Did you pay for a ticket? If you didn't pay for a ticket, it's a free lunch. Life is a free lunch. Point number 11. Price jumps are good news. I have a calculator I'm hoping to develop called the Buy and Hold Reality Checker. And the whole purpose of the calculator is to demonstrate price jumps are not good news. This is the key fallacy. It's a logical fallacy. But buy and holders believe this. Now, does it have intuitive appeal? Yes. You know, you're sitting around with a stock portfolio and prices go up and you feel good. I know how it feels. I had this happen to me. You're looking at your account and you say, yeah, I'm behind on my retirement planning and now I'm in a better shape. Good. But it's not good. It's not good. Price increases are good only to the point that they are justified by the economic realities. And the economic realities in the United States productivity in the United States is sufficient to support an annual increase in stock prices of 6.5 real per year. More than that is cotton candy nothingness. And so if you get a price increase of 10%, 3.5% is being borrowed from future returns. And so all you're doing is playing a mind game with yourself. You're pretending that you're richer when you're really not. And you're going to have to pay it back at a later time. And if you spend the money, if you start thinking it's real and you spend the money, you're getting yourself in a whole big heap of trouble down the road. However, most of us don't care to learn too much about stocks, so we defer to experts. But the people we think of as experts just happen to be employed in the stock selling industry, which means they make all their money by persuading us that stocks are always the thing to buy. And the reality of a capitalist society is that's going to influence people, okay? You know, I think about this. I would compare this to what we'd have with doctors. You know, a lot of us would like to eat 6 pieces of chocolate cake every night, you know, while we watch television. A doctor could make a lot of money by telling us that 6 pieces of chocolate cake is a good thing to eat every day. But the medical field has enough integrity to it that people don't do that. They'd be laughed out of the profession. The stock selling industry just doesn't have that history, and frankly, it doesn't have that level of integrity. And people will tell you nonsense. And if the majority are telling you nonsense, there are people in the stock selling industry that would love to tell you the straight story. I'm absolutely convinced of this. But if they did, they would be driven out of the field. Because if you're telling nonsense, you can't have other people telling the straight story. It's going to make you look bad. This is why Scott Burns, financial columnist Scott Burns, told me, he says, Rob, you're telling people accurate safe withdrawal rate numbers. You're telling people accurate retirement numbers. That is, quote, this is a quote from Scott, catastrophically unproductive. Catastrophically unproductive. How the heck could telling people accurate retirement numbers be catastrophically unproductive? But in a sense, he's right. It's catastrophically unproductive because it makes all the people who are telling wrong numbers look bad. So it's marketing. Marketing, there's always going to be this conflict. The stock selling industry makes money selling stocks, and so they're always going to be influenced by that. The only way I know around it is to open the internet up to honest posting. The credit card industry, you know, is influenced by marketing concerns. They want us to buy stuff we can't afford. But there are 1,000 blogs today telling people how to save money, how to resist the lure of credit. You know, resist overspending. What we need is to have 1,000 blogs telling people how to invest rationally, how to resist the lure of buy and hold, how to invest in a way that makes sense, in a way that works for the long-term investor. But until that day comes, and if that day came, everybody in the field would then instantly be free to start giving better advice. Because they wouldn't be able to get away with giving the phony baloney buy and hold advice. But we've got to build that infrastructure. We've got to build a counter to the stock selling industry. Until there's a counter, their hands are tied. So marketing is dominant. And that's, you know, that's part of the logic of buy and hold today, that marketing considerations dominate. And if you know that the safe withdrawal rate numbers are wrong, you know, all your interest in data and academic research goes out the window because you know that from a marketing standpoint, it is catastrophically unproductive to tell middle-class investors the straight story about investing. Point 13, that indexes are better than stock picking. Well, I think indexes are better in a practical sense for 90% of investors because most of us don't want to study individual stocks enough to identify the good ones. However, I do think it's overreaching. The arguments that Bogle and some others make that stock picking can never work is overreaching. And that overreaching is unfortunate because you lose credibility when you overreach. And I don't think that professionals in a field as important as stock investing should be overreaching in this way. So what we should be telling people is, yes, indexes really are better for most investors. But for those who know how to pick stocks effectively, picking stocks is just fine. And the reason I think we don't do that is again, it's marketing slash emotions. Indexers want to think that they're doing the best. It's not enough for them to know that indexing is best for them. They want to hear it's better than anything. It's better than Warren Buffett. You know, some guy's going to pick an index fund, and he's going to say, I'm smarter than Warren Buffett. And I swear, go to the Vanguard Diehards board, go to the Bogleheads board, and there are people who will say this. They will honestly maintain, and they believe it, that they are smarter than Warren Buffett because they're invested in an index fund rather than picking stocks like Warren Buffett. He's dumb. Warren Buffett is dumb compared to them. Okay. Point 14, keep it simple. This is a key premise of buy and hold investing. I think it's wonderful. We need a simple investing approach. We need it because millions of middle-class investors need to be able to invest in stocks. They don't have the time to research stocks. They need a simple approach. And they need a simple approach to remember it. If an approach gets too complicated, people won't follow it. So keeping it simple makes all the sense in the world. The buy and holders, the logic there is impeccable. We need a simple approach. Point 15, stocks are best. Stocks are the best asset class. Again, I think that's right. There's a lot of people today running in fear from stocks. Sven Bode argues that the middle class should not be invested in stocks, that they should be invested in treasury inflation-protected securities. I love treasury inflation-protected securities. But treasury inflation-protected securities, at one time they were paying 4% real. I own some TIPS that pay 3.5 real. Today, I don't know what they're paying. The last time I looked, it was somewhere around 2% real. I think if you're smart, you can find super safe asset classes that pay 3% real. That's the best you can do. That would take some work, but that's possible. 3% real. Stocks pay 6% real. So you're doubling the amount you're going to have to save for retirement if you rule out stocks. So I can't go for that. I think the buy and hold logic is strong. Stocks really are best. You have to look at valuations, obviously, but stocks really are the best asset class, in my opinion. Point 16, ignore the short term. Again, this is profound. Bogle's idea and Malkiel's idea, the whole idea of the random walk, all this stuff, that you should ignore the short term, you know, changes in price. Pure genius. Where I find fault with the logic of buy and hold, though, is the buy and holders don't really believe that you should tune out the short term. They say it, but if you ask them, what do short-term price changes signify? They will say short-term price changes reflect changes in the economic realities. In other words, they say the market is being efficient. So things are changing in the economy and all these smart people in the market are changing the price in response. So what they're saying is these changes are significant. And if they're significant, you can't ignore them. How can you ignore information that's so important to your future financial health? What I say, what valuation-informed indexers say, is that short-term changes are meaningless. Short-term price changes are just emotion in action. They're pointless. They're a waste of time. So I believe valuation-informed indexers can genuinely ignore the short-term ups and downs. Buy and holders try to, and they're quite sincere, but it's impossible because they believe that the short-term price changes are reflecting something significant. And once you accept the idea that these changes are significant, I really don't see how, as a practical matter, you can tune them out. Point 17, that the market is efficient. This is the big mistake, the greatest mistake ever made in the history of personal finance. All the problems with buy and hold stem from this one mistake, I believe. The mistake is the buy and holders are right to think that the market must be efficient. The purpose of a market is to set prices properly. So the market has to set prices properly. Or it would break down. It would collapse. And we've had a market for a long time. So the market is efficient, but it's not efficient immediately. Eugene Fama jumped to a conclusion that the market is immediately efficient, and it's not, according to the data. according to the entire historical record. If the market were efficient immediately, there would be no such thing as overvaluation. If the market were immediately efficient, that would mean the market is always pricing stocks properly. Well, if it's always pricing stocks properly, how could stocks been priced at 3x fair value in January of 2000? Now, that's a problem to this theory. The reality is the market is anything but efficient in the short term, and is efficient only in the long term, after 10 years or so. And the strategic implication is, when the market is insanely overpriced, and it's heading towards efficiency, meaning it's heading in the direction of fair price, and it's now at 3x fair price, you've got a 2/3 price drop coming up. No wonder we always see a drop of 68% when we're priced at the levels we saw from 96 through 2008. No wonder. How can anybody be surprised? You're valued at 3x fair value. Your market, if market efficiency is pulling you down to fair value, that's a drop of 2/3. Surprise, surprise. We usually see a drop of roughly 2/3. The market's efficient, but it's not immediately efficient. So there's logic. There's logic there, but the logic wasn't fully developed. The efficient market, the buy and hold people figured out that the market must be efficient, and they jumped to a conclusion that it's immediately efficient. They never proved this. There is no proof. There's no evidence. There's not even any evidence. Forget proof. There's not a single sliver of evidence that the market is immediately efficient. That was just a guess, and it was a wrong guess, and Robert Shiller showed that it was a wrong guess, and there's now a mountain of evidence showing it's a wrong guess, and we need the buy and hold advocates to acknowledge that so that we can get out of this trap that this corner we've painted ourselves into. Point number 18, invest for the long run. This is a principle of buy and hold. This is part of the buy and hold logic. Investing for the long run, I think is wonderful. Wonderful, 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 wonderful. It's the future of investing. The only problem I have with it is, under the buy and hold logic, they never define long term. And you have to define it for the concept to be meaningful. And for the average middle class investor, long term is 5 years, 10 years. I would like to define long term as 5 years, but we can't, because the data does not permit us to make statistically meaningful predictions in 5 years. So if we define long-term as 5 years, we can't do anything with it. If we define long-term as 10 years, we can. We can make statistically meaningful predictions 10 years out of stock returns. Not precise predictions, but we can give you a range of possibilities. This is what the stock return predictor does, calculator at the website. And we can assign probabilities to various points along that range. So the logical place to define the long term is 10 years. 10 years. But the buy and hold logic does not define long term. And if you don't define it, it's not a legitimate concept. You know, because, you know, what they do, if you question the buy and holders, they'll just change the definition. You know, you'll show them that what they say should happen in long term never happens, and then they'll just change the definition of the word. And then you'll prove that that doesn't happen, they'll change back again. They just go round and round in circles. If you're not willing to define your terms, you don't possess logic. What you possess is emotionalism. Logical concepts can be defined. That's a characteristic of logic. Logical exercises, logical projects. Point 19, timing never works. Well, almost all the podcasts I do reflect on this. Short-term timing doesn't work. In other words, trying to figure out where stocks are going to be a year from now, that doesn't work. Again, huge breakthrough. This is where buy and hold shines. Short-term timing doesn't work. Don't try it. In my opinion, there are other people say different, but I am persuaded by the data. Long-term timing, different story. Long-term timing always works. Buy and holders don't tell you that, do they? Long-term timing, changing your stock allocation with the understanding that you may not see a benefit for doing so for 5 years or even 10 years, always works. We have data going back to 1870. It always works. Would have been nice if they told you that, wouldn't it? Not only does it always work, it is always required for long-term success. Why? Because if you don't engage in long-term timing, you're going to be one of those people suffering the loss of 68% when prices crash, when prices pumped up by an insane belief in buy and hold causes a massive stock crash and an economic crisis for the entire system. Long-term timing works. Long-term timing is required for the investor who hopes to have some realistic chance of long-term success. So the buy and hold logic is it's a half-truth. There's something important going on there, but it's more false than it is true. If all you say is timing doesn't work, you've said something of great significance, of great truth, that short-term timing doesn't work, but you've ruled out the long-term timing, which is what you have to engage in for your portfolio to work, for your strategy to work. So you've said two things. You've said a great truth and an even greater falsehood. This is characteristic of buy and hold half-truths. And half-truths are half-falsehoods. And the falsehoods are what cause millions of failed retirements, millions of failed businesses, millions of failed marriages. We need to get the stock selling industry to start talking straight, or else we need to develop a counter to the stock selling industry. We need to open up honest posting on investing topics on the internet so that we can develop blogs and websites of our own that give the straight story to other middle class investors and thereby shame the stock selling industry into talking straight on what we should do with our retirement money. This is too important a subject to leave it to this industry that has made hundreds of millions of dollars promoting buy and hold now for 30 years after Robert Shiller published his research on valuations. Point 20, you can't beat the market. Well, again, sounds good, doesn't it? Can't beat the market. Sounds like they're being prudent. Sounds like they're warning you against a danger. It's like saying, you know, you shouldn't play with matches. You shouldn't set off fireworks. Shouldn't go swimming in a pool without a lifeguard, you know. Shouldn't run with scissors. Sounds like they're being prudent. You can't beat the market. Well, guess what? We are the market. Can't beat the market. What saying you can't beat the market, saying you can't beat yourself. Well, what does that mean? You can't beat yourself. The heck does that mean? What it means in practical terms for the buy and holders is you shouldn't try to educate yourself because you can't beat this thing called the market, which is you. We're all the market. It's what the market's comprised of people. That's what a market is. So when we say we can't beat the market, what we're saying is we shouldn't educate ourselves because we can't beat ourselves. So we shouldn't educate ourselves because we can't beat ourselves. Well, what's going to happen if we don't educate ourselves? The market's going to be dumb, isn't it? If the people who comprise the market don't try to beat the market, they don't try to educate themselves, they're ensuring that the market will be dumb. Dumb. Is that what we want? We want the market to be dumb. If the market's dumb, the market doesn't function. If the market's dumb, the market doesn't set prices properly. If the market's dumb, the market is not efficient. If the market's dumb, we end up with stock prices 3 times fair value. If the market's dumb, we end up with price crashes. If the market's dumb, we end up with economic crises. If the market's dumb, we don't get to retire on time. If the market's dumb, we don't get to retire early. We should all be striving to learn everything we can about how to invest effectively. Do you beat yourself when, you know, if you're a runner and you run a 7 minute mile and you try to improve to 6, and if you get to 6, you try to improve to 5? Yeah. Do you beat yourself if you're a swimmer and last week you ran 6 laps and this week you're going to try to run 10, try to swim 10? Is that beating yourself? If somebody told you, well, don't try for 10 laps, that would be beating the market. You don't want to beat the market. You say, what, are you a moron? Of course I want to beat my, you know, they have a phrase, personal best. I want to do my personal best. We should be trying to improve the market every day. every day. That's what investing experts are for, to make the market better and better and better and better and better. And that means we got to beat, if tomorrow's market's going to be smarter than yesterday's market, we're going to have to beat yesterday's market, aren't we? We collectively need to beat the market over and over and over and over again. Saying I can't beat the market is like saying I want to be dumb. You know, there's that saying, fat, dumb, and happy. Not only am I dumb, I know I'm dumb, and I'm deliberately dumb, and I'm happy about it. I'm content with it. I'm not content with it. I built the Retire Early Board at Motley Fool because I wanted to become smarter about saving and investing. And the thousands of people that built it with me wanted to become smarter about saving and investing. We didn't want to sit around fat, dumb, and happy. As the logic of buy and hold argues, we should, and they tells us we can't beat the market. Point 21, this is the last point. What is volatility? Under the buy and hold model, volatility, change in price, is a reflection of changes in economic realities. This is what, you know, if you read Burton Malkiel's book, this is what he says, that what's going on is that the market is seeing that things are changing and prices are changing to reflect that. That's not what the rational model views volatility. The rational model says that if the market were rational, the market, which is us, would understand that stocks in the U.S. have been providing an average return of 6.5 real for a long, 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 long time, and that the price of stocks should always reflect the current value of the long-term dividend stream. And the current value of the long-term dividend stream is unchanging, unless there's some dramatic change in productivity, which is pretty unlikely in a established economy like the United States economy. So there's never any reason for any economic. The market should be the market price, the Dow or the S&P should be going up by 6.5 real, roughly, not precisely, but roughly every year. And if ever it goes up less than that, there's something irrational going on. And if ever it goes up more than that, there's something irrational going on. And we call that irrational pricing volatility. And under the buy and hold logic, volatility is a fact of life. Under the rational model, the valuation-informed indexing approach, volatility is an evil. Because all that volatility is going to do is you're going to get a little extra. If the price goes up more than 6.5, you're going to get a little extra money in your portfolio now in the present. But you're taking it. You're borrowing that money from future returns. So you're hurting yourself in the long term. And of course, it works the other way. If the increase in price is less than 6.5, you're taking a little hurt in the short term, and you're helping yourself in the long term. You're increasing the long term price. So you're just playing games. It's like you're moving money from one pocket into another. But it's not a zero sum game. Moving money from one pocket to another is a zero sum game. But when it happens in the stock field, you move money from one pocket to another. What's happening is you're penalizing people who happen to be at that in the market at that time, at the time when the price is paid back. In other words, in the 90s, when we had huge volatility, we pumped up returns temporarily for a few years, and we borrowed the money from future returns, and we borrowed something to the tune of $12 trillion. So we've now got to pay back $12 trillion, and paying back that $12 trillion has caused an economic collapse. So it's not a zero sum game. We hurt ourselves big time. So under the logic here, there's a surface logic to the buy and hold explanation that, oh yeah, these are just, you know, you might well think these are caused by economic changes, you know, these prices, you know, price changes. But no, price changes, to the extent they're greater or less than 6.5 real, are caused by emotion. Volatility is emotion. Volatility is dangerous, and we all should be working to eliminate volatility. We all should be trying. The way we do that is to educate the market, which is us, about how stock investing works. So you develop tools like the stock return predictor that tell people when prices go up, when valuations go up, the long-term return goes down. And if we publish that information widely, people would learn through experience that price increases that are not justified by the economic realities are not a plus, they're a negative. And we would make the market less volatile, more rational, less risky. Risk is not required for stock investing. Volatility is optional. Risk is optional. We can eliminate volatility if we all work to open the internet up to honest posting, and if we spread the word far and wide how investing really works. It ain't buy and hold, friends and neighbors. We can eliminate the risk of stock investing while maintaining those juicy high returns. I think that's possible. That's the logic of buy and hold. Those are the half truths of buy and hold. Let's work together to move to a more humane, human, intelligent, enriching model than the model we're living under today, the failed and discredited buy and hold model. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.